I see a few, not the ones I was thinking, okay. Yeah, a few of the older people. You know, usually it's the young people ready to go on a dinosaur hunt. Well, my wife and I have had a chance to do exactly that. Most of our dinosaur collection actually comes from not very far from here, up in Alberta, along the Red Deer River Badlands. They're just loaded with dinosaurs. And there was a time in the past when you were still, you know, okay to pick those things up. And so that was really neat. And you pick up bits and pieces of bone. We transport them. We now live most of the year in South Florida, about 100 miles south of Orlando or Tampa, the little town of Arcadia, and have displays of fossils from around the world, plus the ones we help dig up there. And so we have some of these dinosaur bones. But this evening, I'd like to share with you how what we see about dinosaurs fits in with what we read in God's Word, dinosaurs in the Bible. And a lot of times when you say that, even to Christians, dinosaurs, Bible, you know, how can you put those two together? The word dinosaur isn't even in the Bible. How can you talk about what the Bible says about dinosaurs? Well, they're right about one thing. The word dinosaur is not in the Bible. That word wasn't invented until 1841. To me, that is utterly amazing. I'm just sure the young people were digging up, you know, these dinosaur bones, including some of the big ones, dragging them back to their parents and teachers. What's this? What's this? What's this? You know, don't bother me. I don't know. How was it? It took science so long to get interested in these things. It was a Christian, by the way, Sir Richard Owen, the first curator of the British Museum of Natural History, that gave us the name dinosaur. The first specimens reported to science were the more awesome kind and looked kind of ferocious, certainly bigger than any lizard he'd seen. And so we get that name, terrible lizard. Well, that name isn't in the Bible, but in the Bible there are descriptions of animals that match various kinds of dinosaurs. Perhaps the most familiar is Job 40. And so in that chapter, in fact, those last three chapters, God is answering Job's prayer. And so Job has been suffering from quite some time. If only I could speak to God, if only I could present my case to God. And so finally, God answers Job out of the whirlwind. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? And he begins to recite the wonders of creation to distinguish himself from as creator from Job the creature. And he talks about the wild horse and the ostrich, you know, familiar creatures, the stars he calls by name. And then in Job 40, he gets to this creature, behold now. And the translators didn't know what to do with it. And so they just made the Hebrew pronounceable like Yahweh to Jehovah, behold now, behemoth, which I made with thee. And it had bones like bars of iron. His strength was in the muscles of his belly. He could hold his mouth against the mighty rushing of the Jordan River at flood stage. And he had a tail like a cedar tree. Well, some modern translations say, well, it's obvious what that is. You know, it's obviously a hippopotamus. Well, a hippopotamus is certainly, you know, a large, impressive kind of animal. But I ask you, does a hippo have a tail like a cedar tree? You know, a symbol of strength and power throughout Scripture. I probably shouldn't do this, but I did find out, by the way, this is not the tail of a hippopotamus, but a hippopotamus has an awesome tail. And it's an awesome, it's only about as big as four fingers. It's about that size and shape. And so on trip number, I think it was 1,731 to the San Diego Zoo, we were there again. We go there over and over and over. I never get tired of it. Well, here we were, you know, at the hippo enclosure. And you can see them underwater. They look kind of graceful underwater. And coming out, though, well, after you've eaten so much food, you know, God has designed this system. So you take the nutrients you need, and then some of the nutrients that are left over, you know, you return to the ground. So I think you get the idea. So this fellow was getting ready to return some nourishment to the ground, and this little tail began to turn. And it began to turn faster and faster and faster, and sure enough, it hit the fan, okay? And you thought, you know, that farmers invented manure spreaders. No, God was there first. And when I first saw that was about the only time I've ever been at the hippo enclosure when I was about the only one there. And so I see this, I never heard of that, I never read it anywhere. And so I go to take a picture, out of film. Okay, last picture had already been taken. My daughter's got the video camera. Debbie, get a picture of that. And she was changing a video cartridge. So it's kind of like a UFO. For years, I never told anybody I saw that, you know. So, and then a couple years later, this was trip 2415. We were gone by getting close to the hippo enclosure, and I saw one of the zookeepers, you know, and I just asked her, boy, I bet it's fun to live here and work. I'm waiting for him to open a Homo sapiens cage so I can volunteer to be taken care of, nurtured, given a great big habit. But at any rate, you know, oh, yeah, she says it's great to work here. She says, the only thing I don't like is cleaning out the hippo enclosure. Well, I had to ask her. She says, well, you know, they've got this little tail like this, and it spins. It just goes all over the ceiling and the walls. So apparently that really is true, but it's not really a tail like a cedar tree. Well, the other alternative, you know, it's an elephant. And I think you get the idea. An elephant, you know, has a tail like a reed or something like that. Not at all like the thick trunk of a cedar tree. There is one animal that fits the description, though, isn't it? Although modern versions have the tails sticking out, you know, these animals, you know, like the brachiosaurus and the what we used to call brontosaurus, apatosaurus, diplodocus, or diplodocus, is a name that means a double beam. The strength is literally in the muscles of the belly to move the long neck and head on one end and the great big cedar-like tail on the other end. Long necks is a common name for them. All right, quiz time. Ah, see? Pop quiz, you didn't know about that, did you? Okay, this is just a hands-up quiz, though. Hands up all those who think this is a life-size model of the mighty behemoth that once stalked the earth. Ah, there's a hand. Oh, there's one over there, one over there. Guess what? They're right. Okay, in fact, in the state of Washington, the minority is often right. Okay, keep that. But at any rate, this is a life-size model of the mighty behemoth. When? When it first hatched out of its egg. In fact, in this case, now this is just a cheap model and so on, but they've discovered a lot of dinosaur eggs recently. China is famous for some of the dinosaur eggs that are found there. The Milk River in Alberta. There's an area, Egg Mountain in Montana, and then Argentina. And so they found a number of these. Sometimes you can find the little baby dinosaur preserved inside the egg. And some of these in Argentina include the Diplodocus kind of dinosaur. And if you unroll it, it'd be literally this size. And so when a dinosaur hatched out, you know, you could hold it in your hands. You know, you could pet it. You could take it to school with you, put a little string around its neck, take it for a walk in the park. And so it's kind of amazing to think of dinosaurs like that, but none of them have been found with eggs, you know, much bigger than footballs. And so you could actually have a pet dinosaur, kind of like as a child growing up in Florida, I had pet alligators. And of course, they're a lot of fun the first year. They're about this long. The second year, they're less fun. The third year, they get to... The fourth year, you're looking for some place to give them to, put them away, do something with them. And so they can grow quite rapidly, even though they start small like that. And so not at all, it's kind of a surprise to many people to realize that even the big dinosaurs started off small like that. Okay, let's see who can name this dinosaur first. Ready, set, go. Okay, T-Rex. Tyrannosaurus Rex, okay, star of stage, screen, and television. And so on. This is, an awesome-sized dinosaur. And let's face it, most of you got a zero on that first quiz. Okay, now that's an awful way to end the evening. But I'm a very generous-hearted teacher. My students, many of whom are here, you know, came to depend upon that. So I'm going to give you a makeup quiz. And if you do better on this second quiz, I'm going to erase that zero you got and give you your new score. What could be fairer than that? But I've got to warn you. You know, among the creation speakers I've had a chance to work with, one speaks with a particularly funny accent. Ken Ham, the Australian. And so many of you know Ken. You know, Ken thinks that Australians learn faster than Americans. Well, I may learn faster than people from Texas, but I don't think they learn faster than people in Washington. So the honor of America, the honor of Washington is at stake here. Ready? Hands up, all those who believe this is a life-size model of the mighty T-Rex that once stalked the earth. Hey, there's the fast learners. Okay, here's some medium-speed learners. You know, any slow learners? Okay. Yeah, some of you wouldn't vote for anything and deserve the government you get, so there, okay? But this isn't a very good model, but this would be approximately the size of a T-Rex when it first hatched out of its egg. And so you could hold a T-Rex in your hand, you know, you could pet it like that, and you could put a T-Rex on your shoulder, you know, like a parrot. What would happen if you put a T-Rex on your shoulder? You know, bite your ear off, bite your head off, something horrible might happen. And you can see why people might think that. They certainly do have some awesome-looking teeth in the jaw there. You know, and here's a close-up of one. Most of the teeth are much more shallowly rooted than that, but there are four of them that even have a big root. And so this is one really awesome tooth, and then there are a lot of these teeth, you know, in that jaw like that. And some of you might think, wow, you know, that's really a ferocious animal. And we often refer to this as a carnivorous tooth, you know, a tooth designed to eat meat. In fact, my wife found a real T-Rex tooth there in Alberta, and hers was so well preserved, it even had some of the serrations, some of the little jagged edges. And so, you know, it's like a steak knife, you know, for stabbing other animals and ripping them to shreds. And you've seen the movies where it's biting the head off a Diplodocus, ripping the guts out of a Triceratops, wrestling an Allosaur over a cliff, you know, just awesome. But how much of that is based on fact? Let me ask you another question first. What did the first T-Rex eat? Who here can tell me what the first... Aha! How'd you know that? What book did you read it in?
I forget.
Oh, you forget. Okay. Okay, you got the right answer. Anybody have any idea what... Yes, what do you think? That's right. And so that book that you could have read that in was the first book. Okay, the book of Genesis, written by God himself. And so we don't have to wonder what the first T-Rex ate. We can read about it. And so you may not have realized this, but T-Rex is in the very first chapter of the very first book of the Bible, the first thing that God had written down for us. And so it's at the end of the first chapter that God said to our first parents, here he's speaking to people, I've given you every herb-bearing seed which is upon the face of all the earth, every tree in which is the fruit of a tree yielding seed. You it shall be for meat, or that's just the Hebrew word for food. So our first parents were vegetarian. Anybody here? Anybody at all ever eat a McDonald's hamburger? Yes. Is that a sin? Well, it may be a sin against good sense, good health. But it's not a moral sin anymore, is it? Because something happened to ruin the world that God had created all very good. And so after the flood, in fact, God specifically said to Noah and those with him, as I gave you the green plants, so now you may eat meat. But originally, it wasn't just people, it was also the animals that were designed just to eat plants. And so here it continues, verse 30, and to every beast of the earth, to every fowl of the air, and to everything that creepeth upon the earth wherein there is life, and that's a Hebrew phrase that includes the scaly-skinned animals like T-Rex, I've given every green plant for food, and it was so. So we know beyond a shadow of a doubt that the first T-Rex was just a vegetarian. And some people say, well, how can that be? You know, our schools, museums and things are constantly telling us that sharp-pointed teeth are just horrible, or they're weapons of mass destruction and whatnot. And take a look at this creature here. My wife likes to use this in our workshop. What does that animal eat? One young person said, anything he wants to. But in spite of those ferocious-looking teeth, this is just the silver langur monkey, and it's strictly a leaf eater. It just eats leaves. Here's the flying fox. You know, it's a bat, and we've seen a lot of these in Australia. They have a wingspan of about 4 feet. They're a pretty impressive bat. And the little face down here, you know, looks pretty much like a fox's face. And then take a look at the teeth. on this particular animal. Here's a skull. If you found that as a fossil, you know, an evolutionist would say, boy, yeah, that was a killing machine. You know, that probably went after velociraptors. Who knows, you know? And yet this little critter is the fruit bat. And all it eats is fruit. It's very effective at eating fruit. but that's all it eats. It's just a fruit eater. And the list continues. So you take a look at some other creatures. And pardon me, I lost all of feeling in my fingers re-roofing my house after the hurricane. You know, it was 16,000 times gone like this. You get carpal tunnel syndrome. But my brother, the medical doctor, tells me that, you know, at a millimeter a year, in 8 months, I'll get my feeling back in my fingers. So, wow, okay. And take a look at this critter here. And, of course, some of you have seen these. Hopefully not, you know, that close or something like that. But a grizzly bear, you know, they belong to order Carnivora, and they're famous, you know, for, you know, eating meat, you know, snatching salmon out of the river, occasionally a camper out of a sleeping bag. But many of you around here know that about 80 to 90% of what grizzlies eat every year are just fruits, nuts, and berries. They're largely vegetarian, only occasionally supplementing their diet with meat. It's really kind of astonishing. And, of course, the teeth serve very well for that vegetarian diet. Let's see, this was trip 3,581, San Diego Zoo. They were getting ready to feed the polar bears. And for a change, I wasn't way at the back, I was right on the glass. And for a change, I actually had film in the camera. And I thought, this is going to be great. Here came the zookeeper dragging a bag full of food, you know, and the grizzly bear, or the polar bear was waiting for this. And I was all zoomed in. I thought he'd throw this leg of lamb in front of it. And I'd get a picture of this red blood spattered all over this white fur, you know, and I could gross out my students. And so he threw it out in front of the polar bear. Rawr, chomp, 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 chomp. Lettuce and carrots. I couldn't believe it. I thought the polar bear would take another look at the zookeeper. I've got a better idea. But they love it, you know, and it wasn't something they were just putting up with. They enjoyed it. Polar bears also enjoy playing to the audience. You know, they look through the glass and respond when you clap and all that. They really put on a show. And one was putting on a real show, and a zookeeper showed up with just one carrot, one of these big horse carrots, you know, you feed to horses. And he stopped what he was doing, just like a Snickers bar. You know, took time, kicked back, and ate that carrot, you know, before he resumed the performance and so on. And so you can have sharp teeth like that and be a vegetarian. Now, of course, polar bears do eat seaweed. They do eat things like that and garbage and stuff when they get into human areas. They do eat seals as well. But the teeth originally, you don't have to imagine anything to imagine they were originally vegetarian. The panda. I suppose all of you have seen pictures, you know, the black and white teddy bear-like panda. And, of course, if you're willing to stand in line long enough in the San Diego Zoo, you can see one that looks pretty much like the teddy bear in the store. The real trick is to see one move. But you know, for a while, evolutionists were a little embarrassed because pandas just eat bamboo. And yet they have the same mouth, same teeth that regular bears have. So they decided they were really raccoons. And decided they'd do a DNA test to prove that they weren't bears, they were raccoons. The DNA test came back, they're bears, just regular bears. And so you can have, you know, regular animals that, even without sharp teeth, that are still just vegetarians. Same thing with claws. Now, grizzly bears have impressive claws, but this is a claw. Okay, this is an animal that lives in Florida, in Florida, the giant ground sloth that would have stood bigger and taller and weighed more than T-Rex. And this is one of his fingernails. This is just the last joint of the finger, and this is just the claw core. And so there's a sheath over that would extend out even further. The whole thing from the joint to the end of the claw would be about 3 feet long. And so there is one awesome claw. What to do with that awesome claw? Well, it turns out it's just a leaf rake. And so it's designed to rake leaves out of the trees, to bend over the tall branches so the animal can get to the tender leaves and so on. It's just a vegetarian. Although I do have to admit, there is one other possible function for this large claw. Now, we're not positive, so don't quote me as 100% sure. The research hasn't been completely done. Maybe one of the young people, you know, going on to a career in science will one day settle this issue once and for all. It's just possible, maybe it could be, that this is also the world's largest nose picker. Now, we're not sure about that. See, how would you ever prove that? Well, you'd have to find the world's largest booger, right? Okay. Well, moving rapidly along. Here's the skeleton of that giant ground sloth, and we have quite a few bones. We haven't found the whole thing yet, but we've got quite a few bones of this creature in our museum there in Florida. And here's a reconstruction, you know, to show the animal with its fur on, you know, and a couple joggers gone by for comparison. And so you can see those great big, huge claws like that. By the way, just parenthetically, this little guy down here is a giant armadillo, in quotes. It's a glyptodont. We have a lot of those armor plates of these animals there in Peace River. And, of course, now, you know, if you ever get a chance to go to Florida, you see all these flattened armadillos, you know, along the road run over by cars. In the good old days, the armadillos, you know, could step on the cars, you know, so turnabout's fair play. So we got a lot of giants down there. Well, you might say, well, wait a minute. You know, some of these things, how are you going to tell? You know, the Bible tells us God created these creatures originally vegetarian, so we can be sure about that. Originally, they ate plants, but the Bible also tells us that after sin ruined God's perfect world, death entered the world, some of these animals did begin to eat other animals, and after the flood, God said, I'm sure some men had already started doing, but after the flood, God said that people could eat, you know, could eat flesh, possibly because of the deterioration in the food sources in our environment and biochemical deterioration in the human body, you know, we were allowed to eat meat. So, you know, the Bible says, well, they were originally vegetarian, some became meat eaters, how can you tell? Well, here's the answer. Does that look a little bit like something a dog might have dropped in your yard? Okay, if it does, there's a reason for that. Okay, so this is petrified poo. Okay, isn't science a wonderful thing? And I've got the real stuff right here. In fact, I wonder if this one of these young, in fact, both of you can come on up and tell me if this is real, you know. Now, is this, okay, does it, okay. That's real. Okay. Does it smell? Okay. Did it come off on your hand? No, don't worry. See? Then, well, I don't think it comes off in your hand. Maybe. And see, it's, you know, turned to solid rock like that. And it comes in a variety of sizes and shapes. Okay. And, you know, here's another one. This is actually petrified alligator poo. And we find a lot of that in the river. Sometimes we find it when it's not petrified. But at any rate, you know. And then you can find big chunks, you know, in various places of dinosaur poo. And, of course, some of these can be fairly large, like the chunk on the right. And so if you want to know whether this animal is vegetarian or meat eater, if you've got a rock saw, and my wife has a rock saw, you can slice off a piece, polish it, and look at it under the microscope. If the animal was a vegetarian, you'll see bits and pieces of twigs and leaves and things like that. If it was a meat eater, you'll see bits and pieces of broken bone. Have I got good news for the young people here? Some of you have already chosen a career. It's too late to go back. But for those of you that your future is still ahead, you know, you can go back to school. If you stay in school long enough, get enough degrees after your name, you can spend your whole life cutting and slicing dinosaur poo. Wow, okay, what a career. By the way, there really is a PhD in paleoscatology. It gives a whole new meaning to PhD, piled higher and deeper, okay. And let's see, where would you have to go to find a university that would have a degree in paleo poo? Oh yeah, California, that's it. And sure enough, that's where it is. Karen Chin is the most famous paleoscatologist in the world. She's popular, you know, guest on talk shows and science shows and so on. So it really is a real field. And just like trackers in the woods, you know, can identify animals based on the droppings, you can do the same thing with fossils. The technical name, by the way, for these things is coprolite. And so that's what we're talking about. Well, let's see if we can put some of these bits and pieces of evidence together to make some kind of coherent story. And according to the evidence we find from fossils, it really looks like dinosaurs, trilobites, people, all of the things that we find as fossils for reasons I'll say even more about tomorrow when we take a vicarious hike through Grand Canyon. They all live together at the same time. And so the swimming forms, you know, the fish, et cetera, and among the reptiles, the plesiosaurs and things like that were created on day five. The flyers were also created on day five. And, of course, one of the swimmers, by the way, described in detail in Job 41 is Leviathan. Whole chapter on a swimming marine reptile. The flyers were also created on day five, including the awesome pteranodon with a wingspan as big as a fighter jet airplane and so. And then on day six, God created the land animals and man. And so we would have been living on Earth at the same time as the dinosaurs. Now, when you say that to people, sometimes people say, oh, that'd be terrible. I wouldn't want to live on an earth that had dinosaurs on it. We couldn't have a meeting like this. We'd have to post guards with cannons around the church. Otherwise, a dinosaur might step on the building. We'd all be crushed to death, just like Godzilla tramps out Tokyo. Well, that's an exaggeration. You know, Godzilla's not a real dinosaur. And it may surprise you to learn. In fact, I think, really, I've said a few astonishing things. But probably the most astonishing thing I'll say all night is that the average dinosaur was only about the size of a big dog or a small pony. I'm not saying they were all that size. Some of the dinosaurs did get huge, 100 feet long, you know, 80 tons and so on. But even those, you know, hatched out of eggs, no bigger than that. Some of the dinosaurs, the average dinosaur was this size. Some of the dinosaurs never got any bigger than chickens. Chicken-sized dinosaurs. If they hadn't died out, you know, after the meeting, we could go out for Kentucky Fried Dinosaur, right? Okay, well now, believe it or not, there is a group of evolutionists. I think they are actually in the minority, but they are a vocal minority, and they've got the attention of National Geographic and the news media. There is a segment of evolutionists that believes that when you go out for Kentucky Fried, you are getting Kentucky Fried Dinosaur. And so they really think that birds are just feathered dinosaurs. I know one of the hardest things in giving a creation evolution talk is to convince the audience the evolutionists really do believe some of these things. And so here's an example, you know, from a nature encyclopedia. Dinosaurs in Cincinnati Zoo, in this case, which is otherwise an excellent zoo. Dinosaurs went extinct millions of years ago, or did they? No. Birds are essentially modern, short-tailed, feathered dinosaurs. And then here's a nature encyclopedia, you know, that gives the same idea. What's the smallest dinosaur? You know, I told you about chicken size, but apparently they get even smaller. And so according to this, what? The smallest dinosaur is the hummingbird. Isn't that interesting? I know when I moved to San Diego there at ICR, you had hummingbirds all over right outside the window. And so, you know, you ask, what do evolution say if you say man and dinosaur lived together? Oh, no, they didn't. You say, sure, look, there's one now. And some evolutionists are going to be on your side, so you let them fight it out. And one of the groups that's really into that, you know, is National Geographic. And so, according to evolutionists, by the way, it was not the flying reptiles like pteranodon and the other pterodactyls that evolved into birds. It was the T-Rex group that evolved into birds. And National Geographic, I believe it was November 99, had this title on the cover, Feathers for T-Rex, not for pteranodon, feathers for T-Rex. And inside they had the picture of feathered dinosaurs and so on, making this case that dinosaurs evolved into birds. They really belong in the same group. All they need to verify that theory is to find that final missing link between dinosaurs and hummingbirds. And so I don't know. But again, that's not really an exaggeration in the sense that they do believe it came from that particular group. Here's the Geographic article, you know, feathers for T-Rex. And they just make this stuff up. And they show up with crumpled photographs. The first couple of times this was proposed, it showed up as a crumpled photograph. It wasn't even a professional presentation. Then they smuggled a specimen out of China, contrary to international law, the conventions of science, everything else. National Geographic didn't care. They wrote a big article on it, put it on display, ran 100,000 students through their display, in 3 months before they had to admit it was a hoax. And they haven't even admitted it in print so far, but it wasn't even a real specimen. And so they do find bird specimens, they do find dinosaur specimens in Western China. And so, you know, some of the locals are anxious to get in on this. They know where to look. And so they say, you know, what are you looking for? And one of the scientists said, well, we're looking for something, you know, that kind of mixes up reptile and bird traits. And the man, I don't think he was trying to trick them. He said, well, I can do that. I've got fossils of birds. I got fossils of dinosaurs. So he glued some pieces together. The colors of the rock didn't match. It wasn't a clever hoax. It was enough for National Geographic. And they've been taken by smaller things than that. And yet finally the media caught on. Again, there hasn't been a sufficient public retraction, but the missing link that wasn't. Storrs Olson, famous evolutionist at the Smithsonian. Imagine this, Washington, D.C., National Geographic, the Smithsonian. And Storrs Olson, even though he's an evolutionist, wrote an open letter to National Geographic accusing them of, quote, sensationalistic, unsubstantiated tabloid journalism. In other words, the same kind of stuff you pass by in the grocery checkout store. And they had to admit he was right. There wasn't any substance to that at all, but it'll come back. They're bound and determined to make that, whether the evidence fits or not. What did Dr. Morris tell you earlier? You know, I'm committed to materialism. I'm going to make the evidence fit no matter what story I have to tell it, no matter how contrary to the evidence or common sense. So it'll come back. But thank goodness there are serious evolutionists that still have an interest in science that keep knocking that idea down. So actually, they do a good job for us, even if creationists didn't mention it. The vast majority of evolutionists do think that dinosaurs went extinct, that they didn't evolve into birds. The question is, why did they go extinct? You know, they seem to have been so fit to survive, big ones, little ones, all on all the different continents and so on. What happened to them? Well, I got to hear, while he was still alive, of course, Carl Sagan lecture in San Diego on what happened to the dinosaurs. And he said, oh, there are all kinds of theories. It got too hot, it got too cold, they ate too much, they starved to death, and mammals ate their eggs. It was a virus plague, and in his personal favorite, they died of constipation. There was a laxative plant in their environment, you know, that went extinct. And when that plant died out, the dinosaurs impacted themselves to death. Well, good story stuff. But here's the Gary Larson version. You know what happened to the dinosaurs? I'll let you meditate on that for a few moments. But, of course, the modern view, and this is extremely popular. About everybody knows about this. It was a meteor, a chunk of rock from outer space, an asteroid that did in the dinosaurs. Now, I guess in the 70s, in the early 70s, it was very unpopular to believe in worldwide catastrophes. Right here in Washington State, I may or may not remember to mention this tomorrow, but Harlan Bretz's work on the channeled scablands in eastern Washington began a new movement among evolutionary geologists. The evidence just forced them to think of huge catastrophes. And so now they're even into worldwide catastrophe, that it wasn't some little thing. And it'd have to be, because all the dinosaurs died out essentially at the same time on all the different continents. And none of these little environmental reasons would do. And so a chunk of rock, you know, slammed into the earth. Well, are there any chunks of rock out there that could slam into the earth? The bad news is, yes, there are. And so there are several out there that regularly intersect Earth's orbit. And scientists have calculated reasonably that if a chunk of rock just 6 to 10 miles in diameter slammed into the oceans, the most likely spot, there for a while they thought it was the Gulf of Mexico off the Yucatan Peninsula, if it hit the oceans, it would incinerate life for maybe 500 miles, then slosh waves of water over all of the continents. And so now the evolutionists have come to the conclusion it was an asteroid-induced watery catastrophe that did in the dinosaurs. Of course, if it was a watery catastrophe, that would explain why we find their bones among the billions of dead things buried in rock layers laid down by water all over the earth. Like the graveyard up in the Red Deer River Badlands, the evolutionists are saying, wow, must have been a colossal flood here, bigger than anything in human history, except Noah's flood, to bury so many really big animals so deep and fast and preserve their bones before they could rot. And so we would be able to see a relationship between that meteor impact and Noah's flood. Now, the Bible doesn't say that God used a meteor, an asteroid, to trigger the events. It doesn't say he didn't. And it's possible, I suppose, that God used some secondary agent to trigger the events of the flood in his perfect timing. But we would say, you know, there's a record of a worldwide catastrophe that explains what we see. Well, if I did something like that, an evolutionist had turned blue and veins had pop out all over their face. And I'm thinking of several pictures I've seen of just you can't do that. You know, the asteroid hit the Earth 65 million years ago. Noah's flood, if it wasn't a myth, you know, happened only 4,500 to 5,000 years ago. You can't relate that asteroid, you know, a worldwide flood back then to Noah's flood. Or can you? You know, what kind of evidence do we have that dinosaur fossils are millions of years old? Oh, I've got a son-in-law in San Diego that has this little word for the day kind of calendar. And so the word recently was factoid. Well, a factoid, I found out, is something that's been put in print so often people assume it's a fact, even though nobody ever actually measured it. Well, that's kind of the way it is with those millions of years. You see it over and over again. You hear it over and over again. We'll talk a lot more about it tomorrow. But there never was any particular evidence for that. And there's a lot of evidence on the other side. And so I have some friends, including one of our ICR graduates in geology, John Whitmore, was part of a team of five that went to the North Slopes of Alaska and brought back 200 pounds of fresh, unfossilized, unmineralized dinosaur bones. Wow! We have some of these, by the way, on official loan. They actually all have federal tags and numbers and stuff like that in our museum in Florida. Unfossilized, unmineralized. How could they just lie there for 65 million years without just rotting away? You take a chicken bone, you know, throw it in the woods, it's going to disintegrate in a lot less than 65 million years. And if it wasn't fossilized, it's not going to be preserved. And so they went, well, what happened? And you hear a whole bunch of them. Originally, they misidentified them. They thought they were caribou or something like that because they couldn't believe dinosaur bones wouldn't even be fossilized like that. Well, you might say, well, it's the ice. You know, the ice preserved them. But an evolutionist can't say that. From an evolutionary point of view, the ice age, by the way, we're still in the ice age. At a maximum, the ice covered 30% of the continents. It still covers 10% of the continents. And it retreated from maximum only by evolutionist reckoning about 8,000 to 10,000 years ago, pretty close to the creationist idea the ice age followed Noah's flood. Before that, all scientists, creationists and evolutionists, agree the Earth had a mild climate, pole to pole, alligators and palm trees found buried as fossils up there. So the evolutionists can't say, well, it was ice. Because for 65 of their mythical 65 million years, for 64.999 of those millions of years, it was warm and tropical. You're not going to have bones lasting like that. Then the plot thickens. ICR was just thrilled that Dr. John Baumgartner agreed to join the staff full time. Dr. Baumgartner is from Los Alamos National Laboratories, worldwide expert on plate tectonics and all kinds of geophysics and math problems and things like that, wonderful Christian gentleman. He was interviewed in U.S. News and World Report, it was July, I think, of either 97 or 98. Big picture of John, you know, and the caption was, you know, world's leading expert in plate tectonics, believes in a young Earth and Noah's flood. And, you know, it interviewed his colleagues. Oh, yeah, we don't know about young Earth and Noah's flood, but John knows his stuff. He's the one, he's the expert we all look to. And so this is fantastic. Well, he has lots of areas of expertise, including looking at radioactive decay dating. And so he and others have begun to look at carbon-14 in fossils like dinosaur bone. Now, an evolutionist would say, well, that's foolish. They're millions of years old. Carbon-14 has a short half-life. It'd all be gone. There's no point in looking for it. It'd just be contamination. Guess what? They find it, and they find it at 4 times the minimum detectable level, and they find roughly the same amounts in Cambrian trilobites, Mesozoic dinosaurs, in Pennsylvanian coal deposits. All these things that are supposed to be different in age by millions of years do have carbon-14. They could only be thousands of years old, and they all have about the same amount. They all died at about the same time. And this is some revolutionary stuff, and Dr. Morris will be saying more about that tomorrow morning. We talk about the age question. And so it's not at all unreasonable that those dinosaurs were killed in the worldwide, the ones we find as fossils were killed in that worldwide flood. Sue, that T-Rex that was found in South Dakota sold for $8.4 million and all. You know, Dr. John Horner was a science expert for the Jurassic Park films. And he and his students at the Museum of the Rockies in Bozeman, Montana, analyzed those bones, and they were very little fossilized, and there were blood cells, relatively fragile cells, not as fragile in reptiles as human beings, but nevertheless relatively fragile, still inside these bones. Millions of years, no, thousands of years even, only under ideal conditions. And it really looks like we're talking about a recent worldwide catastrophe. But now the fun begins. Okay, if I say these dinosaur fossils that we find around the world on all the continents were buried, you know, 4,500 to 5,000 years ago in Noah's flood, can I use Noah's flood to explain the apparent extinction of dinosaurs? Oh, can't do it, can I? Because if dinosaurs were around when the flood came, and so some of the dinosaurs got buried in the flood and fossilized, where were at least two of every kind of dinosaur? Noah's Ark? You say that to most people, dinosaurs on Noah's Ark? You can't have dinosaurs on Noah's Ark. You know, a dinosaur on Noah's Ark, you know, just tip up, flip over, and sink, or they knock holes in the sides. Evolutionists make all kinds of jokes out of having dinosaurs on the Ark. Well, that's because they don't know anything about the Ark or about dinosaurs. Dinosaurs are nowhere as near as big as evolutionists often try to picture them. The Ark is a whole lot bigger than they ever imagined. And we don't have to guess. The Bible gives the dimensions of the Ark. And so here you see, let's see, there's some of the... Is that Shem or Ham or Japheth? One of the fellows there. Okay, pulling up, you know, with some of the animals. In this truck here, I've got another one that you could have all, you know, several different dinosaurs right there in that truck. And you say, well, what about the one that gets to be 100 feet long? Well, that's the old ones. And so dinosaurs like alligators and other reptiles, fish, and so on, continue to grow out, you know, through their life cycle. So this little guy born this size may get to be 100 feet long, but you wouldn't take that one on the Ark. You want to take one? You wouldn't take the babies either. You know, if Noah wanted to cheat, he could have got all the dinosaurs on the ark in a couple bushel baskets. You know, if he took the eggs, but God's purpose was for them to multiply and refill the earth. So you take young adults. And so we have, you know, near our house, we got 14, 16-foot alligators. But when they're this long, they're ready to lay eggs and reproduce. So you take a young adult. And so maybe one of those 15, 20, 25 feet long, mostly neck and tail. There's plenty of room for those. Of course, the chicken-sized dinosaurs, dog-sized, pony-sized, plenty of room. And so we're not talking about two dinosaurs on the ark. We're talking about two of every kind. Two of the Triceratops kind, two of the Diplodocus kind, two of the T-Rex kind, et cetera, like that. Plenty of room. But of course, if dinosaurs were on the ark, what? They got off the ark. So what happened? You know, when we, you know, none of you had to, you know, drive by dinosaurs on the way here this evening. What happened to them? If they got off the ark, they began to multiply and fill the earth. I think there are two things that happened to the dinosaurs, and one was a dramatic climate change. And for reasons that are actually crucial, by the way, Florida, paradoxically, has got the best, quote, ice age deposits on the planet. We have fabulous ice age deposits. The ice never got down there, but the ice in the northern area drove a lot of animals down in that area. Florida was probably warmer at the height of the ice age even than it is now. And so the flood really just changed the climate of the planet dramatically. And it affected a lot of the large animals especially. About 50 miles from my house, we have the fossil of the world's largest beaver. And so if that beaver stood on its hind legs, you're not even counting the tail, it'd be more than 6 feet tall. A beaver like that shows up in your yard and says, I want that tree. What do you say? take it, it's yours. You're not going to argue with a 6-foot beaver. And there were lots of giants on the earth in those days. Dragonflies with a 27-inch wingspread and so on. And it looks like in the world before the flood, there may well have been a vapor canopy around the earth that acts as a greenhouse gas to hold in heat, bottle it up, just like clouds don't let it cool off as much as a clear night does. Carbon dioxide. Plants today are desperate for carbon dioxide. Our atmosphere is only 0.03% carbon dioxide. Plants are designed for about 10 times that much. The most common enzyme, the most common protein in the world is ribulose bisphosphate carboxylase oxygenase. Okay, known in shorthand as Rubisco. Even the shorthand is fairly long. It's the enzyme that, you know, looks like a lace doily that grabs carbon dioxide out of the air to begin converting it into sugar. It doesn't work very well. And you say, boy, there's evidence God, you know, is a bad designer. No, God designed that enzyme perfectly for the perfect world that He created. It's designed to work with more CO2. Now we're down to this low level. Why? Because at the time of the flood, the carbon dioxide got tied up in coal, oil, natural gas, limestone rock, fossil deposits. The carbon dioxide wasn't released back to the atmosphere to be recycled. It's like throwing off a blanket on a cold night. So the earth got cold rapidly. Land cools off much more quickly than the oceans. Warm oceans, cold continents, the ideal conditions for centuries of snow and ice building up after the flood for perhaps 500 years until finally there began to be a little bit of a balance. What else do you get when you get warm, moist air and cold, dry air next to each other? Well, I guess you don't know up here, do you? But in Florida, we know hurricanes, you know. In the Midwest, they know tornadoes, you know, all kinds of violent weather and things. In fact, our home and museum was in the eye wall of 3 hurricanes in 6 weeks. Okay. And so I hope that's it for a while. And so you get these violent storms, which seem to produce these terrific deposits in Florida. Hypercanes are called super hurricanes. The center of a hurricane is like that, like a straw that sucks up huge amounts of water. It's a hill of water in the middle of a hurricane. And that's where a lot of the damage come from. It's part of storm surge. The wind and stuff does a lot of damage. But here, as you get near shore, you know, here's this big hill of water. A regular hurricane may have a 30-foot hill of water in the middle. A hypercane might have a 100-foot hill of water in the middle. And, of course, if you're a marine organism, and so out there in the oceans, you don't bother to swim around where there's all this turbulence and storms and lightning and all this. You go ahead and swim in the middle. And, of course, even Hurricane Francis, the eye was over 100 miles wide. Some of these hypercanes might be 200 or 300 miles wide. Here you have whales, dolphins, you know, seals, white sharks, you know, all kinds of things swimming around. And then as it approaches Florida, anybody here know how high the mountain ridge is that separates Miami from the Everglades? Okay, ready for this? 20 feet. Okay, that's it. It's the Miami Ridge is 20 feet tall. The tallest point in Florida, 346 feet above sea level. So I know I'm not in Florida when I'm... And so here you have this big hill of water moving toward Florida, all these happy animals in the middle, and then what? They run out of water. All this stuff dumps over on top of what? Some really surprised. Mammoths, mastodons, these elephants, camels, llamas, rhinos, all of these things are found in Florida, rolled together with shells. Big sea creatures, big land creatures together. And by the way, we do family camps and things like that if you'd like to visit the opposite corner of the country. So that climate change would have been real hard on a lot of the big animals especially. But there's something else. You know, it's kind of hard on the people. And the other thing that's interesting, and we have a really good working relationship with the State Museum, you know, in paleontology. And the State Museum in Florida is arguing that these big, large land animals, a giant ground sloth bigger than T-Rex, they were hunted to death by my ancestors, the American Indians. Guess what date they give for it? About 4,000, not 4 million, about 4,000 years ago. And so that's really fantastic. We don't have to worry about arguing over things like that. Here's one. We're involved in an excavation there in Florida. And this is one of the first bones. And this young lady's dad found this thing. And actually, the slide's compressed to fit on this. But this is the femur of a baby mammoth. And I can tell it's a baby because of the growth plate across there. It hasn't finished growing yet. And yet this would already be 12 feet high. The average zoo elephant's about 10 feet high at the shoulder. And so that got even bigger. And so my wife actually helped plaster jacket the largest Colombian mammoth ever found on planet Earth. It's buried about a mile from our house. And so it looks like many of these large animals were done in by the climate change, but once they got to good climate, it was overhunting by people that did in the last of some of these kinds. And so mammoths and mastodons and elephant kind, you know, in Florida died either from the climate change or from overhunting by people or both. But there's ample evidence that these animals and dinosaurs, and of course evolutionists will admit elephants and things like mammoths, mastodons, all those lived with people, and many of those would be much bigger than dinosaurs. And there's also ample evidence that dinosaurs have lived with man. We got to visit, you know, a part of England where St. George, you know, lived, and he's credited with, you know, with being a dragon slayer. And, you know, people used to think that was a myth, but now they've actually found, they have a statue of him and the animal that he killed, and they found the bones of a dinosaur in that area that look like the one that's pictured with St. George. Herodotus, the Greek historian, described a flying reptile so well, we know it was Rhamphorhynchus rather than Pteranodon. And the list goes on. In Portland last week, I had a chance to look firsthand at some of these Inca stones, some of these carvings, etchings of dinosaurs on rock that were done by the Incas down in Peru and so on. And so there's lots and lots of evidence in historical time that man and dinosaur have lived together. And so I like to I encourage people to use dinosaurs as missionary reptiles or missionary lizards. Now, what do I mean by that? I got that phrase from Dr. Paul Ackerman, creationist at Wichita State University. And by that, he meant that when you're telling people about dinosaurs, at the very same time, you can be sharing with them the gospel message of new life in Jesus Christ. And so that's kind of thrilling. So when we take a look at, oh, here, there's several of these, okay? We see evidence of Christ as, oh, I got some of these too, okay? I didn't realize this slide had been doctored up to do the little slide-in thing. I thought it was just one picture. We see evidence of Christ as creator, as sustainer. Remember, it's not deism. You know, it's not that God, you know, created the universe, wound it up, and let it go. No, God daily, faithfully takes care of what he created. So creator, we see God as creator and completed supernatural acts. We see God as sustainer in the way, you know, you look at a dinosaur egg, a little baby dinosaur is inside, multiplication after kind. But we also see evidence of God's judgment because of human sin. That's why we find dead dinosaurs, diseased dinosaurs buried in the catastrophe of Noah's flood. But as we look at that awesome destruction, we realize that all life would have been destroyed had not God provided a way of escape. And so we see these and we look at the kinds of things we find as dinosaurs. Their design shows God's creation. Their death and disease and decline shows the corruption brought about by man's sin. Their rapid burial and preservation shows us the catastrophe as Noah's flood. And their getting off the ark, multiplying and beginning to refill the earth is a testimony to their salvation, restoration. They're being carried on the ark and given a chance to remultiply and fill the earth. So isn't it kind of neat? And by the way, some of you, you know, love to do children's ministry. You got neighborhood kids you want to invite over. Sometimes you can get them to come over for, you know, Bible study, especially if you promise them milk and cookies and so on. But sometimes you talk to kids, you want to come over and I'll tell you some Bible stories? Well, no, I think I hear my, you know. You want to come over and hear about dinosaurs? Oh, yeah. I want to come over and hear about dinosaurs. And so evolutionists have been doing that for years, using dinosaurs to teach young people about millions of years of struggle and death. We can use dinosaurs to give them the good news of new life in Christ. And so their way of building the family of God, using those as witnesses. If we don't use dinosaurs or don't tell the truth about dinosaurs, there are plenty of people willing to tell them lies about dinosaurs, aren't there? And so here's a quote from a famous evolutionist. I'm convinced the battle for humankind's future. And that's what Dr. Morris talked about. There's a war of the worldviews. By the way, that's the title of an ICR video, a 20-minute video. One of the few short videos creationists ever produced. And it's awesomely powerful. It's a great introduction to creation, you know, to any kind of group. War of the worldviews. There's a battle going on. And where do they think the battle's being waged? In one of the public school classroom by teachers, and I'll just skip ahead here, teachers what? Utilizing a classroom instead of a pulpit to convey humanist values, not virtues, but values, in whatever subject they teach. But at least we have to give the evolutionists credit, don't we? They do wait until the children reach the age of accountability, and they do provide them with both sides of the information so they can make up their own mind in a spirit of, no, they want them right away, you know, regardless of the educational level, preschool, daycare, or big state university. They want, what they want is for you to plunk the little girl or boy right down in front of the TV so they can watch dinosaurs rip each other to shreds. And by the time they get to kindergarten, they've seen so much struggle and death and struggle and death everywhere. You tell them the good news of God's perfect world, and it sounds like a fairy tale because they've already been sold another fairy tale. Boy, oh boy, it begins very early on here. And so the classroom must and will become an arena of conflict between the old and new, the rotting corpse of Christianity, together with all its adjacent evils and miseries, and the new faith in humanism. So there's a battle going on out there. One side, the evolutionists, take it very seriously. The other side, a lot of times, too many Christians, you know, battle? What battle? You know, my air conditioner works, you know, and I've got friends, you know, I've got a job, you know, what battle? The battle is for our children, and it's a serious battle. And in that battle, praise God, thanks to a lot of it, to the leadership of ICR, when I first went out speaking, are there any books on this? Well, Dr. Morris wrote one. That was about it, the Genesis flood. But praise God, it's expanded greatly since then. We've had a chance to do some. My wife and I, here's a book for young people, Skeletons in Your Closet, about human origins, cast as if it were in a public school classroom and the debate that goes back and forth. We've got several dinosaur books. One of the most popular is Dr. Gish's. Kids just love to know the names and statistics of dinosaurs. And they're all in that book with the biblical framework. Dry Bones and Other Fossils. The first children's book I ever wrote is translated in over 10 languages and puts fossils, you know, in biblical perspective. We've got several dinosaur books. One of the best, it was the first, by Paul Taylor, this great dinosaur mystery in the Bible. Really gets your thinking sorted out. For the really young ones, John Morris has this, What Really Happened to the Dinosaurs. There are even sticker books out there. For a little bit more, John Morris's The Geology Book, you know, gives you a frame of reference, and we'll be looking at that a little bit more tomorrow. My newest book, The World Around You, it's a book on ecology, from a Christian perspective, deals with that, climate change and how that affected and diet and teeth and population control, you know, before and after the flood and things like that. And tomorrow I'll be sharing with you the testimony of my change from evolution to creation, summarized in this book, and then put together with the physical sciences and Dr. Morris in the book, What is Creation Science? Okay, so I guess that brings us to the end of our time together this evening, and I think Pastor Jim maybe has some announcements to make. We'll look forward to seeing you tomorrow, and during the day tomorrow.